Straps that hold the guardian ring. Biting through the shifting power leans to you, and the corner is on a wheel. Good morning, Colin Talk Radio. Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for Wednesday morning call and talk radio here on Kibu Community Radio, where the time is about 24 minutes before 8 o'clock. And I want to let you know that this program is made possible in part by Kibu Foundation members and a grant from Timbuktu's World Music CD Shop, featuring sounds from around the globe, plus American roots and eclectic contemporary music. Timbuktu's, located at 4726 Southeast Hawthorne in Portland, is now open 7 days a week. More information is at 503-239-0179 or on the web at timbuktu.com. And I'm Barbara Bernstein, and thanks for joining me on our Wednesday morning call-in talk show. And this morning we have a guest, Eric DePlace, who is a senior research associate with Sightline Institute, an organization you may recall, they used to be called Health Watch, Northwest Health Watch, I mean Northwest Environment Watch, excuse me, and we've had them on before. I think we actually had Eric on a couple of years ago, and every year they come out with a report that's now called Cascadia Scorecard about how well our region's doing in about seven different areas of environmental concern. And they just came out with a new report called Focus on Sprawl and Health, the Cascadia Scorecard 2006. So good morning, Eric.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Sure. So this year's report, let's first of all tell us a little bit about Sightline Institute and how you've and where you've grown out of.
Sure. As you mentioned, we used to be called Northwest Environment Watch, and I think your introduction was a perfect illustration of the fact that nobody could remember our name. It turns out to be a little bit of an albatross for us because we work on a lot of environmental issues, but we work on a lot of other issues as well, including kind of a broad range of sustainability issues. The organization has been around for about 14 years, but we've decided to change our name recently to Sightline Institute. We're still based in Seattle. We're still working on the same range of sustainability and environmental issues. But with the new name change, we think we have a little more appeal and I hope a little better chance of getting folks to remember our name correctly.
So, yeah, actually, we have a show called Health Watch.
Oh, you
that's,
do?
That's
okay.
Where my, and there's a lot of watches. And
yeah, there are.
I mean, I don't know how many email lists I get from different watches. So I think it's probably nice to get away from the watch name.
I think it is. We were sharing, I guess you could sort of say, mind space, as corporate marketers would say, with lots and lots of other groups.
So why Sightline?
Why Sightline? Well, one thing, we wanted to avoid some of the connotations of Northwest Environment Watch, but we were hoping that the name Sightline would give people one, kind of an empty vessel, something rather than connotating a specific kind of range of ideas. It would be an empty vessel that we would be able to define in people's minds what we were doing. But also, we like the word sightline because it implies perspectives on different things. If you think of a sightline in the theater, everyone's looking at the same stage, but there are many different perspectives on what's going on up there. So we're hoping that we can provide or at least help inform some of those perspectives. As you say, we work on a range of different indicators, seven different indicators, and we're hoping that those seven different indicators can be something like different perspectives on how the Northwest is doing toward becoming a sustainable place.
Well, I found it interesting when I saw that you changed your name. I was just last weekend at this conference of progressive PR people, basically, and there was one group that was represented that they had changed their name from some unwieldy alternative energy thing to fresh energy, and I thought, well, I think that means even less than what the name meant before, but again, it was like a five-part, name. But I think it's interesting when groups do change their name and they're trying to be catchier and try to get, that marketing branding. You're still there?
Yes, I am. It looks like they have a little interference on the phone there.
Okay. Anyway, it seems, I guess people don't want me talking about this, but anyway, it seems that sometimes there's, like, the content is taken out of the name as well. So I wasn't exactly sure what Sightline referred to, though, as I was reading the scorecard last night. I was sort of getting along the lines of what you're talking about. So I think that I wish you well with a good name. I hope I'll remember your name if nobody else does.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
So this one focuses on sprawl and health, and we'll touch about some of the other issues that you go over in the report, too. But since we've been talking a lot about sprawl and health on the show for the last year, it's an appropriate thing to talk about once again. So I think it's becoming pretty well known that there's been a number of studies that show that the closer people live in community and the denser a community is, the less likely people are going to be obese. And you seem to follow that connection a little bit further. So let's talk a little bit first about how the density of neighborhoods affects people's actual health.
Sure. It's a great question. It turns out that there are actually a huge number of ways in which the density of a community or even the design of the community impacts people's health. Most of the time when people talk about urban design or urban density, they're leaving out the public health perspective. But as you say, I think over the last year or so, it's become something that's started to circulate more in conversations. We're seeing more and more research on this subject. And you have this kind of this whole range of issues that are affected by the way a community is designed, everything from car crash collisions to the chances of having physical activity, to reductions in obesity, to air pollution effects, even social capital. Just a whole range of things. But in terms of obesity, obesity is an epidemic that I'm sure everyone has read about in the papers a lot. In Oregon, it's doubled. The rate of obesity has doubled since 1990. That's fairly typical across U.S. states. But what isn't typical is that the rate of obesity in Oregon is now almost double what it was in a place like British Columbia. That wasn't true in 1990. So something has happened in Oregon, in Washington, Idaho, and most of the rest of the United States that hasn't happened in places like British Columbia over the last, let's say, 15, 16 years. We think that part of the explanation actually has to do with community design.
Okay, let's talk a bit more about that, because I'm just reading a book right now by Mike Davis called Planet of Slums, which is about density in cities around the world. And in fact, he has these figures about how the poor, comparing the density of poor neighborhoods in these mega cities in third world countries, mainly with the wealthy areas. And of course, the wealthy areas, he was describing one place which had a density that was a little bit lower than the neighborhood I live in Portland, which is, I consider, like a mid-density neighborhood. And then the poor people live, like 17,000 people per square mile or something. But,
wow.
But yeah, really dense.
Yeah.
So, and we know that kind of density is not healthy. It's not healthy because the other things you have to also consider is how many people there are per toilet and things that we don't think about here in the first world.
Right.
So, and a lot of people in the Northwest actually think about density and they'll think about New York City or Hong Kong or maybe the slums of Mumbai or something like that. And they're not thinking of density as something that you would actually think of as an amenity. So I think it's important to put the design aspect in. And let's talk about what it is in design as opposed to density that makes people have healthier lives.
Yeah. And I actually wanted to underscore what you're saying. That's a great point. What we're talking about when we're talking about density is not something like the slums of Mumbai or, Rio de Janeiro's favelas or something like that. We're talking about, those places do have major health impacts. There's no question about it, both because they lack the public infrastructure and because they're simply overcrowded. When we're talking about density, we're talking about densities that are on the order of, there are sort of a couple thresholds, 12 people per acre. At 12 people per acre, which may sound like a lot, but actually isn't. It would be a low-density neighborhood in the city of Portland, or a lower-density neighborhood in the city of Portland. You start to get kind of the first wave of positive benefits from density. And then when you step up to something like 40 people per acre, which is probably, this is off the top of my head, but probably pretty similar to the Pearl District, much, much less dense than Manhattan, then you start to see this kind of the next wave of health benefits at that density. And when we're talking about, health benefits, this is, of course, all in the context of, living here in North America where we have adequate infrastructure. We don't have, kind of high-rise tenements and all the stuff that we might associate with a with a dense, overcrowded third world place. So I just wanted to thank you for making that point, because it's a very good one. But now to circle back and sort of answer your question about the features of community design that matter. It turns out that, you know, a lot of it is just getting back to kind of the basics, back to the fundamentals of the way we used to build cities, which was with people in mind, not with cars in mind. That means sidewalks. It means buffers between where pedestrians move and where the cars travel. Those buffers can take the place of trees. Those buffers can take the place of other barriers. And shops and buildings that are designed kind of with people in mind, not with their primary purpose to serve the car. When that happens, you start to see people walking more for exercise, and not just for exercise, but actually for transportation. And if you think about, and this is what's always fascinating to me, we have this rising obesity epidemic in the United States, but most people don't go overnight from pack on 15 pounds or 20 pounds or 25 pounds in the course of a week. Mostly, what happens, and I can speak from personal experience here, is it's a subtle thing. It happens, it's a pound a year. As you get older, you slowly accumulate a little bit of weight. But it turns out to prevent that slow accumulation, that pound a year or so, we're not talking about a lot of physical activity. We're talking about just a few minutes a day of physical activity can be enough. You're burning enough calories in just a few minutes a day to kind of offset that slow, steady accumulation. So as we design neighborhoods that help people choose active forms of transportation, walking or bicycling instead of just driving, you start to see that just in those kind of everyday interactions with the world around them, you can prevent that pound or that pound and a half a year from kind of slowly packing on to my midsection.
Well, let's talk also about, I think it's one of the concerns is that you can have the infrastructure, like you can have the sidewalks and the nice trees along the sidewalks, but people also need some place to walk to or bike to.
Right.
And as you're talking, and I was sort of calculating in my head the density of my neighborhood, which is kind of one of the perfect walkable neighborhoods in Portland. And it's an old neighborhood. Old by Portland standards, but it's a neighborhood that hasn't changed a whole lot in infrastructure since probably the 1930s or 40s, and it still has that style of a lot of neighborhood businesses, almost all small businesses, and sidewalks and parks to walk to. And it's also kind of just a mid-density. I'd say maybe there's 20 people per acre in the neighborhood, so it's a little higher than what you're saying is the beginning point, but certainly under an urban density of parts of Northwest Portland. But I look back and I think about what it is that takes that will actually get people to walk to places. And one thing that I noticed, and I didn't see this in your figuring it all in your scorecard, but there's been a real growth of farmers markets. And my neighborhood got a farmers market about a month ago. And every Wednesday afternoon, there's just people walking on along the sidewalks to and from the market, carrying their little baskets and shopping bags. And it's become another focal point for neighborhood gathering.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's also because you talk about community building in report.
Right.
And it seems like farmers markets are a really ideal way to build community. So I wonder if you could talk a bit more about some other ways in which it's not just having the sidewalks, but what kinds of places actually get people to walk to them.
Right. And again, just absolutely great point. Of course, it's not just having sidewalks and crosswalks that make people walk. It's the fact that, there's a grocery store right down the street, or if I want to go buy a six-pack of beer or some flowers, or I want to run out for whatever those ordinary things are that people run out for on a daily basis, well, there's a way to walk within, a relatively short distance, not miles and miles, but nearby. And so it turns out one of the most important things we can do from a public health perspective is simply kind of reverting, it's getting back to basics, getting back to the basics of the way cities used to be designed, which is not a strict segregation between, residences. Maybe, in suburbs you'll often see whole subdivisions of residences that are pushed off on one side, and then maybe across a busy highway you'll see grocery stores and shops and jobs and all that sort of thing. But instead, to provide some kind of mixture where you have residences that aren't are a few blocks or a handful of blocks away from some of those basic services, the kind of things that people need to access every day. So that kind of the whole structure of our economy, or at least many aspects of the economy, can be integrated with the places that we live. And so you're exactly right to say that it's not just density alone, it's not just neighborhood design, but there's also just some kind of basic zoning stuff that can really improve the physical activity opportunities for people. And I think the farmer's market example is great because farmer's markets, which are proliferating throughout Portland, also here in Seattle where I'm from, turn out to be a great way to get people to start walking and start thinking, oh, okay, this is a way that I can serve some of my basic needs, my basic economic needs, in the context of my neighborhood. And then it also, as you point out, has this great benefit where people start to come together and it starts to build something like community. I mean, not only do you get to meet and talk to perhaps the farmer who grew some of the food, but you meet your neighbors and you talk to them, and you're kind of all participating in this shared experience in your neighborhood. And it turns out that aspect that researchers call social capital also has big benefits. And it turns out that social capital, in many cases, not in all cases, but in many cases, there are higher levels of social capital in kind of traditionally designed places with a little bit higher density, with kind of some of those back-to-basics characteristics that I was talking about, tend to have higher social capital, and as a result, tend to have some positive health benefits that come out of that. People are looking out for each other. There's kind of this social integration with the neighborhood and community around you, and that turns out to be a really positive health benefit for people.
Well, I'm talking with Eric DePlace, who's a senior research associate with Sightline, and we're talking about the latest Cascadia scorecard to come out, which focuses on sprawl and health. And if you want to join in the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187, and it's about 9 minutes before 8 o'clock here on Locus Focus. I guess as we were talking about places to walk to, and I'm thinking, again, I guess the other part of density is the importance of preserving green space, which is something that we've been looking at a lot in this program. And another side of community is having community gardens and parks and places where people gather in nature or do things that are related to nature. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that's anything that you looked into in your research.
It's actually not something that we included in our research, at least not in this particular book, but it is a good point. I mean, certainly designing to accommodate larger numbers of people in a smaller land area, you know, certainly doing things that increase density, encouraging infill and things like this, turns out to be really good for preserving green space. So from the perspective of watersheds and wildlife and all that, which is hugely important, I mean, it's this kind of design is great.
Let's go back a little, because people are going to think, what are you talking about? I mean, it sort of depends. Where are you preserving the green space and the watersheds? Are you doing it in the cities? Are you talking about protecting green space outside of the city?
What I was meaning just now was actually green space outside the city. Although it also turns out to be a good way to preserve green space inside the city as well, in some cases, depending on how you construct the density. And it depends, of course, a lot from place to place and particulars of it. And that's the sort of stuff that we've touched on a little bit in some of our past research. We didn't do much of that this time. We wanted to talk more about how community design benefits people. But, you know, I was reading some research recently, and it was about the interaction, just the sort of incidental interaction with nature that kids have. And it was actually, there were studies of mostly low-income communities in cities back east, and it turns out that just even the most sort of incidental contact with nature, whether it's just having trees outside of a school or having a green playground, or I don't know if they mentioned community gardens, but things like that, turned out to have a huge benefit on educational outcomes. If you took a kid from a place that didn't have any contact with green space and nature and put them into an environment where they did, attention spans lengthened, all sorts of just sort of basic social and educational improvements that they think may be associated with the ability to participate in kind of that that sort of green infrastructure around them. But like I said, we didn't talk about that much in this. In this particular book, but I think there is kind of a large and interesting body of research that's just starting to emerge on these interactions.
Because I'll also throw out, because this is something that's been pushed by a number of community activists here in Portland, that if you want people to buy into increased density, because Portland historically has not been a very dense city except for its urban core, that you need to be providing some natural spaces within the city. I mean, and that was, like, in my decision to move into a relatively dense neighborhood 13 years ago, the big selling point was that at the end of the block is 160-acre wildlife refuge.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, Portland, I think, has done a very good job in preserving a lot of nature within the city in certain neighborhoods, and there's other neighborhoods where there's really very little nature or even decent parks.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Seattle, which used to be a city of trees, I saw a figure last year where there's way fewer trees in Seattle now than there were 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's a great point. In fact, the city of Seattle is just now embarking on a sort of massive urban forestry restoration campaign for precisely the reason you mentioned. You know, Seattle hasn't preserved the acreage of parks inside the city like Portland has.
And also it's sprawled outside the city. It hasn't preserved the farmland outside the city either. It's basically sprawled.
That's right. Yeah, and I mean, we didn't have up here. We haven't had the controls on kind of urban and suburban growth. We didn't have them as early as Oregon had them, and so we paid a real price for that up here. And as a result of that happening, you know, I think we're suffering some of the health benefits from that as well. Car crash collisions, for instance, you know, which are of course, this is sort of an obvious thing to say, but car collisions are pretty closely correlated with how many miles you drive. So when you design big cities in which, or big metropolitan areas in which driving is not just the norm, but is a necessity for transportation, well, it's not surprising then that you would start to see higher rates of car fatalities. And that car fatalities, which, and again, this is, you know, sort of an obvious point, that's the number one killer of people under the age of 45, under the age of 50 in some cases.
Well, actually, I want to get more into some car crashes in just a moment, but I want to let people know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO, and we're talking with Eric DePlace, who's a senior research associate with Sightline Institute. If you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. We're talking about the Cascadia Scorecard 2006 that focuses on sprawl and health. And hello, you're on the air.
Well, hi there.
Hi.
You know, this is a great conversation, and this whole idea of moving about and preventing obesity is something that was inadvertently brought up by Portland City founders, who have put in Southwest Portland, going up every hillside just about, at the end of every street just about, stairwells everywhere you look. And at the top of each stairwell, fascinatingly enough, is a Benson bubbler. And this was put in so long ago because people were living up in the hills, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And they had to get up there. There used to be tramways up to the hill, the West Hills, of course, in the old days, in the 1880s or 50s or something, 60s or something like that. But the city fathers actually put in these stairwells because they knew people would be going home by walking and so forth. And you go out in the west side of town, and it's everywhere, and what a great opportunity to enjoy the nature of the West, some of those preserved forest areas of the West Side, but also to get home or to get to wherever you're going and work your body like nobody's business. I just thought it was interesting that the city fathers inadvertently gave us this beautiful thing.
I wonder how inadvertent it was, actually. I mean, I think that the Benson bubblers are a very conscious move on the part of Samuel Benson to keep us watered.
They put one at every top, one at the top of every stairwell. Hey, you need a drink.
Right.
Okay.
And I'm glad the caller brought that up. It's a great example of what happens when you design city and city transportation infrastructure with people in mind, with foot traffic in mind, rather than with cars in mind. And that's, you know, it's not something that we see that much anymore.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, what's interesting, and I haven't been going to Seattle as much as I used to, so you can tell me what's there compared to what's happening in Portland. But
sure.
In Portland, there's been a great emphasis on bicycle paths,
mm-hmm.
and both there's paths on every, on most of the major arterial routes. In some cases, an actually safe path. In some places, I'm not sure that they are as safe for bicycles as one would like. But besides the paths on the streets, there's also off-street bicycle paths, and there's one that follows the Willamette River from Sellwood down the south end of Portland all the way into town and into the beginnings of northeast Portland. And that trail not only is a very nice trail, a lot through nature, because it goes right along the river and through Oaks Bottom, and you for about 3 miles you are just not in the city, even though you are in the city. And then when you get a little bit closer into town and you're in the more urbanized part of the bicycle path, there's a whole series of water fountains, which was what I was thinking about when the last caller mentioned the old Benson water fountains.
Sure.
And that it is, I mean, as a bicycler, I know as a bicycler where all the water fountains are on my different routes, and it's a really great thing to know you can stop and get a little bit of water as you're bicycling. But this has been a real conscious effort in planning. Now that on the bicycle paths, actually, there's little signs with mileage and time on your bicycle and how to get to different places. So there's a whole thought about how to do signage for bicyclers. And so there's a kind of a dual signage happening. There's the signage for the cars, and there's this other, whole other signage for bicyclers.
Hmm.
And I'm wondering if anything like that has happened in Seattle in the last few years.
I think the preservation of urban green space, I think Seattle's playing catch-up a little bit. You know, we're starting to see the beginnings of that kind of stuff. We're starting to see more sort of dedicated thought about how do we create a transportation infrastructure inside the city that serves bicyclists, not just cars. But I think we're definitely playing catch up to Portland. Now, some of the reason, there are lots of reasons. I mean, some of it is sort of historical accident. Some is that many of the urban neighborhoods in Seattle are really steep and don't serve bicycles very well. But a lot is just that that the city has not invested in that kind of bicycle infrastructure to the extent that Portland has. I think that's a shame, of course, because I'm also a cyclist. I commute downtown to work a couple of days a week, or at least I try to. But it's not a very pleasant ride once you get into the downtown core here, and that's just because the city hasn't been as conscientious about building some of those kind of key pieces of infrastructure. You know, the car is king in most cities around the Northwest. You know, certainly if you look at and this is true around the North America, in fact, the car is king. You know, and I think the one comparison I think is interesting to make, there are always comparisons between Seattle and Portland that are interesting. I mean, our two cities have a long and interesting friendly rivalry, I think. And from where I sit, Portland's often the winner in those rivalries. But I think the interesting comparison too is to Vancouver, BC, north of the border, which is kind of the third big city in the Northwest. And in Vancouver, BC, which has actually much higher density or much higher percentage of people in higher densities than even Portland, you start to see kind of the next generation of what urban design could look like for people. And since Vancouver, BC, since, you know, over the last decade or decade and a half, when they've really invested in improving not only the density in kind of the central city area and in the central city kind of broadly construed, but also really spent a lot of resources in improving pedestrian infrastructure and bicycle infrastructure and things like that, they've had a really strange thing happen. Car trips have declined, and every other mode of transit, bicycling, walking, they've all been rising and rising steadily. So you're starting to see the creation of a pretty large-scale community that's really where the car is not king anymore, where you start to see all kinds of wonderful benefits for physical activity.
Well, I haven't been up to Vancouver in about 5 years, but my last experience driving through it to get actually out of Vancouver, I was not impressed. And, I mean, it seemed to me, what I've always liked about Vancouver is there's no freeways through the city.
Right.
And so I think that's really, well, that maintained the integrity of the neighborhoods, at least in the 70s and 80s when I used to spend a lot of time there. But it seemed to me that when the high-rise densification of Vancouver started, what, about 15, 20 years ago, that it, a certain sense of community actually got lost. When the last time I drove through and I was going down Georgia Way and, you know, doing the whole trip out of town, mm-hmm. It seemed to me that what I remembered of being this city that was not real high density back in the 70s or 80s,
right.
But it was had a very strong urban sense and a very strong sense of all the community stuff that makes a city a place that you want to be in, that was starting to be sort of eroded by having all these high rises that did not seem to me to have the same quality of humanness that the old city had. And that, I mean, maybe things have changed now, but it seemed like there was an awful lot of traffic in Vancouver. Of course, one of the bridges was out. I mean, they were it was a sort of a Portland thing where, you know, you have three bridges not working and suddenly there's a huge more traffic congestion. And it's not there's more traffic on the roads. It's just that there's fewer places for the traffic to go. So I'm curious if you were to drive through downtown Vancouver now at rush hour, if there would still be as many cars on the street as there were 5 years ago.
Right. Well, I suspect if you were to drive through downtown Vancouver at rush hour, you would be quite congested. But that's the interesting thing, actually. They're sort of a double-edged sword. But Vancouver has really sort of bitten the bullet on that and said, well, congestion is going to be really bad for cars during rush hour. But the Vancouver planners, I think, had a lot of foresight because they thought, well, look, we're stuck here on this little peninsula. We don't have a lot of high-quality farmland in lower British Columbia, we just kind of have the Fraser Delta. That's going to be the prime stuff that's going to get eaten up by suburban sprawl. And we want to preserve our forests and nearby nature, too. So they said, well, we're just going to live with congestion for cars, but we're going to make it easy for people to get from place to place, but they just won't be able to do it in their cars quite as easily. And so they invested in a lot of transportation infrastructure that was non-car-centric, so things like high-quality bus systems, certainly a robust pedestrian infrastructure, and bicycles. So in many places in Vancouver now, there's no need for a bus schedule because the buses run so often and so quickly that you simply just need to show up at the bus stop and jump on the bus that will be along in just a couple of minutes. I wish that were the case. Where I live in Seattle, it's not the case at all. Of course, we also have awful traffic congestion. Portland frequently has bad traffic congestion, too. It's probably...
We have a good bus system in Portland.
You do have a great bus system in
yeah.
Portland.
Yeah, though you right. do need to use the bus schedule. Though I'll say something about... I lived in New York for quite a while, and I go mm-hmm. there a lot, and there's no bus or subway schedule in New York, and mm-hmm. the theory is you can just hop on a bus or subway.
Right.
But
it works most of the time in New York.
Well, you can also wait 15 to 20 minutes
yeah, right.
for a bus. So it's like I almost prefer the schedule, and like, you know, so I don't stand and wait for 15 minutes for something that is going to come or not going to come. But, like, continue what you were saying.
Well, what I was going to say before was that I think that the comparisons to Vancouver are particularly interesting. As I was saying before, we think that one of the differences, between the obesity rate in British Columbia and in the United States, and it's about half in British Columbia as it is in Oregon and Washington. We think that one of the differences is actually just the opportunity for incidental physical activity. Even the city of Victoria, which is much much smaller than Vancouver, the share of residents who live at kind of compact densities is much higher than either Seattle or Portland as a percentage of the population, and so as a consequence, incidental physical activity, whether it's walking for groceries or walking to the farmer's market or maybe riding a bicycle or simply not driving as much, and driving alone is, of course, a very sedentary activity. We think that is part of the explanation for why our Canadian neighbors have done a bit better than we have in terms of reducing obesity. And, obesity isn't just an aesthetic issue. It's one that's associated with a whole range of chronic illnesses that some researchers are very concerned about in terms of American life expectancy. Urban design isn't the whole picture, certainly, but it's one way that we can begin to kind of fight back against some of these forces that are taking a real toll on U.S. life expectancy.
Well, I'm talking with Eric DePlace, who is with Sightline Institute, and we're talking today about urban sprawl and health. You're listening to KBOL Portland, listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, and 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. If you want to join in the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. One of the things that I was interested in as I was reading the report and looking at density, that there seems to be, I wonder how in doing these studies there's a difference between looking at urban density and then what goes on in rural areas, because rural areas are way less dense, and I'm wondering, is there a bigger increase in obesity in rural areas where there's only like less than one person per acre than as opposed to just comparing urban and suburban areas?
I don't have the exact figures right in front of me, but it is true in generally speaking, folks who live in exurban or rural areas, there tends to be, and I don't want to make a blanket statement, but there tends to be a higher rate of obesity in those kind of places, and obesity rates tend to be lower in cities.
So is the argument that we get everybody out of the countryside and into cities, or cities everywhere in the countryside?
No, certainly not. But that I think would not be right at all. But it is, I think, fair to say that we should be a little more conscious about how we allow our cities to grow. I mean, in many places around, and I think this has happened even to a small extent in the Willamette Valley. It's certainly happened in the Puget Sound Basin. You have lots of places that when I was growing up, when I was a kid, were rural places. They were country places. And then by the time I was in high school, they were bedroom communities. And now when I drive around, they're indistinguishable from the rest of the suburbs. What's disappointing about that is not just the loss of farmland, the loss of kind of a rural lifestyle in western Washington or in western Oregon, but that these are places where every trip must happen with a car. There are very, very few transportation choices. That has health benefits, as we've been pointing out. It also tends to strand people who don't drive. And those are not just people who have consciously chosen not to get a driver's license, but these are children and elderly people who end up being quite socially isolated in sort of sprawling suburban environments like that. And I think we're starting to see some of the health consequences from that as well. There's a great quote from Winston Churchill, who's an eminently quotable guy, but he once said, when they were considering a renovation of, I think it was the House of Commons, he said, we build our buildings once, we shape our buildings once, and thereafter they shape us. And I think that same point that he applied to a particular one individual building can actually be applied to the collection of buildings that make up our cities in aggregate.
Yeah, I read that quote with quite a bit of interest, and I'll let you know that you are listening to KBO Portland. If you want to join the conversation this morning, we're talking about a focus on sprawl and health. That's part of the Cascadia Scorecard. We're talking with Eric DePlace, and you can give a call at 503-231-8187 if you want to join in the conversation. I did find it interesting that the quote from Churchill, and thought about how that would probably sum up the thoughts of people who are really making the connections between having a good urban design and having healthy communities, and not just health in terms of physical health, but also social health and mental health. And I'm wondering about, let's talk about some of the design principles apart, because I still think we're pretty vague, and most times when I talk to people about this, it's kind of vague about what these places look like.
Mm-hmm.
And do we want places to look like the Pearl? Because I think one of the problems that I have with the Pearl and other places like that is you've got high density,
mm-hmm.
but you basically, for the most part, have a lot of, in the case of the Pearl, a lot of expensive shops and galleries mm-hmm. to walk to, and a very, very expensive food store.
Right.
And there are not the services that you need in your everyday life. And that's true of a lot of these reburgeoning mm-hmm. communities. And I visited one in Baltimore last year that, all great old post-colonial housing stock in the red brick row houses and the beautiful housing. But you have to drive just to go to the supermarket.
Right, right. No, that is a fantastic point. And I think, there's lots of reasons to be positive about the kind of redevelopment that's happened in the Pearl. And I don't mean to pick out just the Pearl, but lots of places like that. In Seattle, it's Belltown or the Denny Triangle. And, there's one in every city. But you're absolutely right to point out that we have not yet figured out exactly how to redevelop or I guess you could say gentrify some of these neighborhoods, increase the density in them. And make them actually sort of real-life practical places, where you can walk to a moderately priced grocery store, where you could go out and have a meal that isn't going to empty your wallet, and where there's more to the kind of walkable urban infrastructure than just high-end galleries.
See, I'm not even sure that there's a dry cleaner.
Right.
It's certainly not a laundromat in the Pearl. Actually, they lost their hardware store, moved over to the mm-hmm. Kebu neighborhood. The hardware store, which was this classic old hardware store in Portland, couldn't sustain the rents, and it had been in Portland, been in the same location for probably close to 100 years. I just go down the line thinking about services. There's no shoemaker. There's none of these basic things that you would need to have in your neighborhood, all of which are in my neighborhood. And so I basically can walk, and there's no post office even. Oh, there's a post office in the Pearl, the main post office, so I'll take that back. But actually, there's a big difference between going to the main post office in Portland and going to your neighborhood post office, where it's going to be a lot easier to,
right.
Lines are shorter and is a lot less intimidating. So I think that these are the kinds of things that we need to think about. And there's a lot of neighborhoods in Portland that still are built around this clustering of usable, very necessary
mm-hmm.
businesses. But the Pearl, which was basically a bunch of warehouses, factories, and railroad yards.
Right.
So it was really building a residential neighborhood from scratch.
Right.
Somebody wasn't thinking, I think.
Well, and I think it will take some time to get all of that exactly right. It's got, because, as you said, they're building it from scratch, and so there's a whole set of difficulties that are related to that. But if you look at kind of the more traditional neighborhoods, perhaps the neighborhood you live in Portland, I'm trying to think of some of the neighborhoods in Portland off the top of my head.
There's like the Hawthorne,
yeah. Certainly is a great
Irvington
example.
Irvington is another example.
Yeah, is there one called Fremont, I think, that's up sort of northeast or something like
no,
that?
No, that's in your neighborhood.
No, one in Seattle.
We have a Fremont Street. There's the Mississippi neighborhood.
Okay,
which is an up-and-coming neighborhood, which Still has a bunch of services. It was a neighborhood of empty storefronts,
okay,
circa like 1910 to 1930. And there's a lot of really cool businesses going in. I don't think there's a shoemaker there.
Okay.
I mean, actually, shoemakers are a dying breed.
Right.
We're lucky to have one in Selwood. But there's there's still a lot of, it's all like neighborhood businesses, and it's not getting too high end yet.
Right. So I will make one sort of pitch, and that's we're coming up with a little sort of web-based tool to let people find out how many businesses they can walk to, to answer precisely the question you're talking about, which is like, can we walk to things that are of practical practical economic value, or take a short drive to them, even if we can't quite walk. And we're going to have that up on our website, which is www.sightline.org, because I think you're asking a very good question about, well, how exactly do we negotiate, designing new neighborhoods or redesigning neighborhoods in a way that allows people to actually get to places they actually need to know or actually want to go to. And, you know, that works pretty well in some of the more traditional city neighborhoods, not working quite as well in new suburbs, not working quite as well maybe in some of the new designed urban core. I don't have the answer to that, certainly. I know in the neighborhood where I live, I can walk to a lot of stuff, but some of the stuff I can walk to are, you know, marine supply stores, or, I live in the Ballard neighborhood of Seattle. So I can walk to quite a few businesses, but many of them aren't going to be of use to me unless I need to outfit a ship to go to Alaska or something like that.
I like that you live in a neighborhood with marine supply places.
Yeah.
There's not enough marine supply. I mean, that's a dying breed of business, too.
It is, yeah. But there's still quite a few hanging on in my neighborhood. But as it turns out, it's a neighborhood that's similar to some of those traditional neighborhoods in Portland, where there's still kind of a mix of core businesses.
Well, you have like a little Main Street in Ballard.
Yeah.
And Ballard, to me, feels like another one of these Northwest small towns that got swallowed up by a city, but it still has its, which is the same. I mean, Portland's got a number of neighborhoods like mine that were once, we were separate towns, and they, in the turn of the 20th century, got swallowed up, but they maintained that sense of like a Main Street and a business district and a clustering of residences around it and a real sense of, I think that there's some parts of Seattle and Portland that still have held on to that small town characteristic, which I think is what we're actually looking for.
Yep, I think that's exactly the right way to put it, a small town characteristic in a city. That's a really, I'm going to have to borrow that in the future. That was
okay.
Good. That was good. And that is, in fact, what happened to Ballard. It did used to be its own city until about the turn of the century, and then it was annexed into the big town.
Well, I'm talking with Eric DePlace, who is with Sightline Institute, and we're talking about the latest report on the health of our region, the Cascadia Scorecard, and we're talking about sprawl and health. If you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's 17 minutes after 8 o'clock here on Locust Focus. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I used to live in Vancouver, B.C., and I just wanted to talk about the interface with the waterways and how Portland really lacks the interface with the waterways, because we have freeways and trains and businesses along our main river route. And I think that really takes away from our sense of, centering, having a center for us, because in our hot Portland summer days, we all have to get into our car and drive out to clean enough waterways to go and recreate and enjoy our time. And in Vancouver, for example, you have this model where they've taken the waterways and made it very easy to interface with them. And it's very close and very convenient for people to, feel like they can recreate and interact with the water, and it's clean enough to do that there.
Well, I think that's the big key. Actually, think about like English Bay Beach and Kitsilano Beach and stuff like that.
Right, and the walk and.
Because actually, Portland has a lot of interface with the water. I mean, it's really changed. When I moved to Portland in 71, there was an expressway along the west side of the river downtown. That's now Waterfront Park. And, I mean, if you are a bicycler, you'll know, I mean, you can do this wonderful loop, either walking or biking along both sides of the river. But I do agree that the freeway that goes along the East Bank, for part of the East Bank, is a turnoff. But actually,
it's more than a turnoff. I think it's the Willamette it got voted one of the third most endangered rivers, and we have a freeway over most of the river on our most valuable property in our city.
Yeah. Well, actually, I don't. The freeways are a part of it. The other thing is that there's really nice beaches on the Willamette just south of the freeway. I mean, when you get it is, and it's Ross Island, which is about to be reclaimed by the city, and it's become another nature park. And I think there's a lot of work that's happening to re-nature the river. There's another issue, though, which has to do with the pollution in the river. I used to swim in the Willamette 20 years ago. KBOO was downtown, and in the late afternoon, a friend of mine and I would just go jump in the river right by the Hawthorne Bridge. I'm not sure if it was actually safer to swim in 1978 than it is now, but we thought it was safe at the time. I think there's been more studies that have been done. I also don't know exactly how clean the water is in Vancouver. The difference in Vancouver is on the Strait. And so I don't think it's as easy to pollute the Georgia Strait as it is to pollute the rivers, but I would really doubt the Fraser River. It's Fraser that goes through Vancouver, right?
Right.
And I don't think that you'd want to swim in that river through Vancouver either. I mean, the Fraser has an awful lot of pollution issues, too. So the problem is just generally urban rivers have not been well taken care of for the last 150 years, and there's efforts to try to rectify that now, but it's a very, very long job to clean up the Willamette or the Columbia or the Fraser or the Sacramento or any of the other rivers that go through major cities here. I mean, and then you don't even want to get to the rivers in the East Coast. I mean, if you ever look at the Hudson River in New York, you wouldn't even consider jumping in.
One of the questions that I have is, after living in Vancouver, I felt like people had a higher sense of civic responsibility and could interface with their communities more. And I thought maybe some of that was based on the security people felt from having health care and being able to go to doctors and then, you know, have more time to go and create community and interface with these getting out and walking to the store instead of feeling so rushed that they have to drive through the drive-thru to feed their families.
I'm curious, in your sense in Vancouver, do you think that people do less fast food eating and that whole style of living in your car than they do here in the Northwest part of the United States?
I think there's a real sense of community and a real ability to get out and interface with culture in Vancouver. And I think that's very well rewarded. And I think a lot of people took time to get out and take strolls and to re-interface with, their local business areas. And I've really found people getting out and actually walking a lot and doing a lot of things out in their neighborhoods and even talking amongst each other more.
I'm kind of curious, where do you live in Portland?
I'm in Southeast.
Where in Southeast?
I'm the Hawthorne District.
And you don't feel like people are out there interfacing, as you say, and meeting their neighbors and walking a lot?
I do in South. I don't know necessarily. I would maybe compare that to Seattle. I feel Portland does have a really great sense of community, and I think the public transportation system in Vancouver and Portland are both really great. And I guess I would compare that maybe to other cities like the Bay Area that I've lived in or Seattle.
Compare it how?
In the sense of people not having enough time to get out and create community and feel civic responsibility to pick up the trash in their yard or, you know, out in the street or I really felt when I lived in Vancouver that people took time to take care into their community and their there's a real sense of community there.
So I'm just asking, I'm curious. So you're saying you do feel like that Portland compares positively to Vancouver, or are you saying, okay, and then Seattle and the Bay Area you think are a little bit less that
right,
way? Okay.
Right. I think Seattle and the Bay Area would be in contrast. And one of the questions I'm asking is, or what I'm feeling is that the healthcare issue, having healthcare and not looking to work 80 hours a week to sustain yourself gives you a lot more opportunity to get out and do those things.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. Let's see if Eric has any thoughts about that.
Yeah, well, I don't know how much of a role in particular health care plays. In fact, we haven't done sort of comprehensive surveys of social capital that are of a caliber that allows us to compare social capital between these cities, especially between Vancouver and Portland and Seattle. But we do know that people in Vancouver and in British Columbia as a whole drive a lot less. So I can't say for sure that people are eating a lot less fast food, but it's reasonable to think that people are at least in their cars or in drive-thrus a lot less often.
No, actually, the first when I traveled across Canada for the first time in 1970, the first place in Canada that I saw drive-thrus, and there were A&W root beer stands, was in British Columbia.
Oh, sure.
And then actually, I thought British Columbia was the most U.S.-ified of all the provinces in Canada.
Right.
And that was back in the early 70s. And maybe it's a little different. I haven't spent any time in other parts of Canada since then, so I wouldn't know. But I thought there was an awful lot of fast food in Vancouver in the early 70s.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's fast food, all over the West. And by the West, I don't mean the Western North America. I mean Western countries in general. I mean, there's a lot of fast food in Europe, too, and even in Eastern Canada and, of course, the Eastern United States. But people aren't driving as much in Vancouver. We're looking at something like a 45% lower rate of car crash fatalities. That's partly because people are just driving a lot less. And when they are driving, they're driving in an environment where you're not likely to suffer a fatality.
Good luck.
As it turns out, congestion is actually pretty good for safety. You might get an fender bender, but you're very unlikely to end up with a serious injury or a life-threatening injury. The next time you're stuck in traffic, you can think about how safe you are while you're puttering along.
I'll remember that the next time I'm
I'm sure it'll be a great comfort to you.
Right. I'm so safe. Actually, I mean, there's other kinds of dangers, though, I think, that you encompass when you're in traffic, and there's a lot of mental stress. And yesterday I spent the day running all my errands on my bicycle. I felt so good. Mm-hmm. But, there's a thing of is you're just kind of sailing along on your bicycle, and I was actually bicycling downtown, and somebody had just pulled over in a lane. They'd stopped. There were two trucks that had stopped on the same road where the light rail is downtown. And so all this traffic was just backed up behind them, and nobody knew what was going on.
Right.
I was on my bike. I was able to go along by the side and go, they're just parked here. And moved on.
Everyone else is suffering the frustration of being stuck behind.
Right. So those are those little smug moments you have as a bicycler or as a pedestrian. I remember years ago my friend and I were walking around in the Portland State area, and we were just looking at all the people stuck in rush hour traffic. And it was this wonderful feeling of, like, we didn't have to be driving. We were just, because she lived right by Portland State, and we could just walk everywhere. So I think that's a sense, I mean, we don't have to be smug about it, but there's a sense of real freedom from that when you get out of your car.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think you've beautifully described the sense of freedom that comes from say bicycling, and I think the same is true of walking. But even riding the bus, which doesn't seem like a very glamorous activity, can also be sort of a psychologically freeing experience because you're not battling with congestion yourself. You have time to read or do other things.
And you don't have to look for parking.
You don't have to look for parking, exactly. And it turns out to be almost 10 times safer than riding in a car, riding on a bus. Mile for mile, riding a bus is one of the safest ways you can possibly move around a city. So to the extent that we begin, from a public health perspective, as people switch transit modes and start moving from single car driving long distances to riding in a bus, that's a pretty strong positive gain, just from a public health perspective.
Well, we've got another caller here, so let's see what they have to say. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah, yes, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I had a comment about, you were talking about how Portland is a really bustable and everything, and to some extent I agree with that, but at the same time, we have, in Portland we have a 24-hour industry of, people who work all kinds of hours, third shift, at Fred Meyer, grocery stores or in warehouses, et cetera. And one of the disappointing things about this city is that, with TriMet, we've got a huge gap between about, 12:30 at night until, I think about 6 or 6:30 in the morning where the buses and the Max just doesn't run.
Well, some buses run, but it's very curtailed. I totally agree with that. You have to be very creative, I think, in order to get to some neighborhoods after midnight here in this city.
Right. Like if you live, for example, if you live, say, in Gresham or whatever, and you've got to commute all the way to Beaverton, for your job, and you work a late shift job, there's almost no way to do it on TriMet.
But actually, I'm going to interject for a second. This is something I don't think that Sightline has looked at, but there's a problem if you live in Beaverton or live in Gresham and commute to Beaverton to work. I mean, the problem being it would be really great if you didn't have to go all the way across the metropolitan area. And I think that's another issue about people being able to live much closer to where they work.
Yeah, that's
that's true too. Unfortunately, the job market in this town, it's gotten better over the years, but it's still not such that you can really pick and choose, you know.
Right. Yeah. But for me, that's not the problem of the individual. It's something that it should be looked at region-wide, and the planner should be going, there's something wrong with this picture. We should be able to provide housing where people work and jobs where people live and not have people going across. And that would cut out so many car trips. Because I live in a neighborhood where people are working in Washington County and commuting back to Clackamas County to where they live. And so I get the brunt of every day at rush hour, the traffic going over the Sewood Bridge. I get a feeling of, you know, I feel sorry for these people that have to drive probably 45 minutes to get between work and home. And wouldn't it be nice if they didn't have to do that?
Right.
Yeah, I think some of that is simply because, you know, cities are getting larger and larger, and so stuff tends to be spread out just as a function of the pure size of the city. But there's a lot to be said for a conscious design policy and a conscious sort of growth policy that at the beginning integrates homes with businesses and puts job centers in places that can actually be reached by transit or by other modes of transportation effectively, rather than what we see in a lot of cities. And this isn't, you know, this is certainly not true only of Portland, but where you see, you know, businesses just sort of or job centers anyway just sort of scattered around in places that make it quite difficult for people to access them.
Caller, have any more comments?
No, that was all. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling. You know, I'm thinking as we're talking about this, the other problem, I mean, in Washington County, where there's definitely a lack of housing, though it's hard to imagine because you see all these housing developments going up all over the place there, but there was a concern about, you know, that. So they're doing all this, building all this housing out near Hillsborough, and they developed this little community called Orenco Station, which was supposed to be an old-style town where there was mixed use and there was apartments above stores and a whole bunch of stores, and New Seasons is out there. And the two things that amazed me when I went out there, the first one was I thought it was on the Max Line. Well, it's a half mile away from the Max Line.
Oh, right.
And so you're walking across. I think all that has been infilled now with housing, because I was out there about 2 years ago. But you got up the Max Line, it was like this prairie, and then you saw in the distance this little old style Disneyland kind of like skyline. I thought, the little town on the prairie.
Right.
And then, you know, I walk out there, and it was still basically, I mean, it was kind of nice in terms of what they were, the idea was nice, but it still looked very fabricated. There was nothing organic about the way that it felt, and it was none of the businesses there were locally owned businesses. They were all, some of them were Portland businesses, but there was nothing that was like unique to Renko Station. It was all these Portland chains that were out there, and it just had a real disingenuous feeling about it. Not quite as bad as this Bridgetown Village shopping mall that opened up a couple of years ago, which is another make-believe town without any housing, though. But I wonder about, if we're doing these plans, how do we create places that actually have a sense of place as opposed to feeling like you're at Disneyland?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, those are great questions, and I'm probably not the most qualified person to answer. You know, how would we design places that feel like, you know, sort of human communities? I suspect that there are sort of two things at work. One is that sometimes I think it just takes time for something to start to feel like things that are new often are a little bit garish, and it takes maybe a few decades even for something to kind of age, and let's hope it ages gracefully, and maybe over time there's a transition to something that feels like a more authentic place that people actually look forward to interacting with. But I think the second thing is actually, and again, this kind of just goes back to bread and butter basics of the way we used to build cities, which is, let's look for opportunities to infill rather than going out kind of into a prairie or something and constructing an entirely new community that stands on itself. Let's think about smart, conscientious ways that we can infill. Like, you know, for instance, in most cities, and actually the Pearl is an example of this. Maybe as you point out, they didn't get it exactly right. But where are places inside the city that perhaps are brownfields that can be rehabilitated, or other empty spaces, empty lots, underused spaces inside cities, where we can, sort of inject a smart mixture of businesses, perhaps local businesses or small businesses, and residences. In many cases, I think one big benefit of infill is that in many cases in Northwest cities, we're not the East Coast where things were built pre-car and there's high density. but on in the kind of the West, a lot of the neighborhoods are just below the threshold where they'd really start to realize some of the benefits of density. Just getting up to 12 people per acre would make transit more viable. So if there are places that are a little below that threshold, and we can do some kind of smart strategic infill and bump us up to that 12 person per acre threshold, well, then all of a sudden you might start to see kind of a flourishing of accessible transit service, of some kind of walkable neighborhoods and things like that. So I think some policies that would actually look at the places that are just kind of on the margins and try and improve them might be a better strategy than building out a whole cloth somewhere outside the city.
Well, it seems to make sense to us, but of course the developers would much prefer to be building stuff out of whole cloth. So, and the other thing is that there is definitely, I mean, you and I might like old neighborhoods, but there's a lot of people that like the new and the shiny stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole, our whole culture is based on something that's brand new. So people want brand new cars, brand new houses, brand new cities, brand new highways. And then once the dazzle is off, and we've seen this in lots of communities around the country, and to a lesser degree here in Portland, I'm not sure up in Seattle, where the shiny new shopping center opens up, everybody goes to it. A year and a half later, it's already obsolete. The shiny new shopping center has moved somewhere else, and that old, that shabby old year and a half old shopping center is a ghost town.
Right. Well, I think, you know, it's you know, human desire is a complicated thing. People want a shiny new house, and maybe they want 40 acres of green lawn. But people also don't want to be in congestion. They also want to have access to services, and they also want, I think a lot of people also want to have some form of community. So, but I think as we start to see urban neighborhoods, and I think this is happening in some places in Portland, in some places in Seattle as well, and I think it's happening in Vancouver too, as people start to realize that, oh wow, you know, there are places where I can live my life, transact my businesses, commute to work, and not suffer some of the negative consequences of, you know, a grinding, you know, 45 minute or hour long commute one way in heavy congestion. I think, you know, people might start to reevaluate some of those things, and you know, who knows? I mean, the future of urban planning and urban design is unclear to me. I mean, it could be that we'll find a way to accommodate some of that desire for the new and the shiny in ways that still kind of honor authentic human communities and traditional urban neighborhoods. I just don't know, but I do think there's a lot of reason for optimism on this score.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I was thinking of another thing that motivates people to walk, and I'm not sure this is the direction we want to go in, but when I'm in New York City, I walk way more than I would in a place like Portland,
sure,
or Seattle, because you aren't going to drive. And there's nothing that would get me into a car in New York. Occasionally, I do take cabs when I have to go long distances with lots of luggage. And the subway is not real pleasant, and the buses are not any better than driving because you get stuck in traffic on the buses.
Right.
So I find that if I'm going to be going a mile or less, I would always walk in New York, and I did that when I lived there too. And I've really got to go a ways before I'm going to even get into public transit, and I have to be pretty extreme situation before, and also costs a lot of money to take a cab.
Right.
So it's kind of the last option. In Portland, it's a lot more attractive to drive. And it's a lot more attractive to drive a half a mile. And like the New Seasons in my neighborhood, it's 9 blocks from my house. The parking lot's actually not that great. And maybe because the parking lot's not that great, I kind of don't like driving there. And I walk there or bike there almost all the time. But if I have to carry a bunch of stuff home, I might drive. It's a lot more attractive, though, to drive that half mile in my neighborhood than it would be to drive that half mile in New York, anywhere in Manhattan or Brooklyn, for that matter, or many parts of Queens.
Yeah.
So is it that we want people to, the options to walking and bicycling being so obnoxious that they've driven into...
Well, I don't know if I would put it quite that way, but I think you did put your finger on something that's hugely important to the way we design neighborhoods and the way we design transportation infrastructure, and that's just parking. You know, there are many, many cities. I don't know what Portland's ordinances are, but if it's like most cities, there are minimum parking requirements when a business goes in. That's sort of an odd thing. One thing that Sightline has talked about doing is reducing or just simply deleting requirements for businesses to
actually provide. Portland has reduced those, and they can be offset by bicycle parking, or
right.
if it's in a transit oriented area, then it's transit oriented development. In fact, they can have no parking spaces.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that Portland is actually moving, and it's been criticized in some quarters because there are a group of people here who talk about the car haters and that Portland's been taken over by the car haters. But I do think that that's one place where Portland has really been a pioneer.
Yeah, well, and that's certainly positive. I mean, our perspective is, look, we're not saying don't build parking or you can't build parking. We're just saying let's not make it a law that you have to. So this is a place in which we're really on the side of the developers, saying, look, let's get rid of some of these restrictions. There's no reason that a city should have a regulation requiring somebody to build all kinds of impervious surface and require them to build a ton of parking just because they're building an apartment or a condo or a business in a city neighborhood. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And there's a great new book that's come out recently. It's called The High Cost of Free Parking, which I think is a kind of hilarious title. But it takes a look at some of those, the very real economic, urban, health consequences of urban policies that have required parking. And so as a consequence, you know, you can go around to any number of places, particularly kind of smaller and mid-sized cities, and find, you know, kind of a sea of surface parking lots in what should have been kind of a traditional Main Street urban environment that encourages walking and bicycling. And so as a result of these forcing people to build parking, you've boosted the cost of new development, which puts the hurt on affordable housing, and B, you've created an urban environment that just isn't human friendly. It's designed with the car in mind, not people in mind.
And besides, we're creating heat islands as well.
Exactly. And there's all sorts of other stuff. Stormwater runoff can be a big problem. Impervious surface is a huge problem. There's no reason that we should devote a ton of impervious surface just to parking when there are lots of other sort of better uses of that land, I think.
It's another funny thing about some of these developments that are trying to recreate the flavor of old Western towns, whether it's Orenco Station here in Oregon or there's a very large mall in Marin County I went to, and I parked in the wrong place. I kind of parked along what looked like a sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
And I go into this mall, and it's like this make-believe town, and it's completely pedestrian-oriented. There's no cars anywhere. And, you know, it was plastic, but it was okay.
Right.
And then as I went out, I noticed behind the mall was like 20 acres of parking lots.
Right.
They were hidden, you know. And Orenco Station is the same thing where you go, like we were, and I was there and went into New Seasons on the, you know, the sidewalk entrance, which turned out to be the back entrance. And then I looked out in the back and there's this parking lot for the entire Orenco Station.
Right. And so it's sort of a Potomkin Village in that way. You
right.
drive to get there, but then you can, once you're there, you can walk.
Yeah. But it's not really solving the problem, I think. And it's just creating, I mean, it's just hiding the cars, but they're still the main source of how you get around. And you're still having all these impervious surfaces.
Right.
Well, I also was interested in talking about the miles used, because I noticed in your statistics, what Germany or Europe, the average gallons of gas that people burn per week was a little around 7.1 or something?
Yeah, I'm struggling to find the right number. I think it was actually a little bit lower than that in Germany, probably.
Yeah.
That sounds more like a number for British Columbia.
Right. And are they actually, are those imperial liters, though? Or
No, we converted everything to the same measurement.
Because I noticed in Oregon it was about 8 gallons per person.
And
much lower than the rest of the Northwest.
Oregon residents would be consuming about the same amount of gasoline per person as Washington residents, actually.
So what is it, the Idaho residents that are...
The Idaho residents would be burning a bit more gasoline and diesel per person. It's not surprising. Idaho is a largely rural state, and even the biggest city there, Boise, is a quite sprawling city.
Mess, yeah.
So there aren't many transportation options there besides driving, and that's, you know, a pretty petroleum-intensive activity. Which has, you know, big consequences, I think.
I thought that you didn't break it down, though, in parts, you know, like into smaller regions. I'd be curious to know how many gallons of gas somebody who lives in close in Portland uses per week as opposed to somebody who lives in outer lying Clackamas or Washington County.
Yeah, it's very hard to get precise numbers for that kind of stuff without doing a lot of intensive primary research. But that's a great question to ask. And I think you'd find that, this is sort of an obvious thing. If you're living close in Portland, you're probably not driving as many miles. Either you're taking shorter trips or you're not driving much at all. And if you live out in the suburbs and you're doing that 45-minute commute one day or one way, that eats a lot of gasoline. And there are real consequences to that, not just in terms of air pollution that's a consequence of burning petroleum, but also it's expensive. It's getting more and more expensive all the time.
Well, actually, your charts and graphs made me, inspired me to do some personal calculations. And so I calculated out that I think I use about 5.5 gallons of gas a week at the most. But I used to use about 12.
Right.
And it's been a conscious lifestyle change. I mean, it's partly where I live, and I live in a neighborhood where I can walk. I also work at home, but I used to just do a lot more driving for whatever reason.
Sure.
And you mentioned in the report that it had a lot to do with the price of gas. And I think for me, that might have been the last thing, but I think it was more like also making some conscious decisions over the last couple of years that I really needed to drive less and have change my habits accordingly. I'm just wondering if you saw any trends, if there are other people like me who've cut their gas consumption in half over the last few years.
Yeah, you know, one thing that's really interesting that that people are always shocked to hear is that on a per capita basis, and this is not aggregate, this is per capita, on a per capita basis, gasoline consumption has actually gone down slightly, not just in the Northwest, but in the whole United States. Now, it's a slight decline, but it's been happening slightly, it looks like, over the last couple of years. This is especially true in the Northwest states. So I think people are taking a look at the price of gasoline, at their lifestyles, and, you know, they're probably not making the kind of cuts you're talking about. Those sounds like, you know, substantial conscious lifestyle changes, but starting to trim around the margins. And I think that actually matters a lot. I mean, it's so easy to look in the newspaper and you hear all the media hype about how many Hummers were sold last year. Well, the number of Hummers sold last year is dwarfed by the number of hybrids that were sold last year. So a lot of the good news is actually getting obscured. Now, we're not reducing our gasoline consumption anywhere near at the rate that we would to actually address global warming, let's say, in a serious way, or actually reduce our addiction to, imported petroleum in a serious way. But the trend line actually may be moving in the right direction over a couple of years now. So I think that there is at least some reason for optimism. That's just not getting picked up anywhere. Nobody's talking about that. Few people are anyway. I shouldn't say nobody's talking about it.
Well, I've actually been – I see these little statistics kind of like, sort of inserted in the edges of reports that I've been reading. But it's true that I think that we need to encourage the positive as well. I want to let you know that we're talking with Eric DePlace this morning. He's a senior research associate with Sightline Institute, and they recently, or actually today, released a report called Cascadia Scorecard 2006, and the focus is on sprawl and health. And again, if you want to join the conversation, we've got another 14 minutes left of the show. You can call at 503-231-8187. I want to let you know that coming up this morning on KABU at 9 o'clock, it's Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller discusses controlled mass media with Norman Solomon, author and syndicated media critic, and Brent Cunningham of the Columbia Journalism Review. At 10:30, Alon Robb hosts a special program on the World Cup with guests from India and the Netherlands. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, it focuses on the movement to end violence against women across the globe. The guests are playwright and activist Eve Ensler and prison rights activist Kimberly Crenshaw. I also want to let you know that this Friday at 10 o'clock in the morning, I may be wrong. It may be 9 o'clock in the morning. I hope somebody will correct me about this. I don't have this in front of me. But we're going to be running a speech that Michael Pollan gave as one of the Illahi lectures. He gave it in May, and this is a speech that looks at sustainable food systems and looking at where the food you eat comes from. He focuses a lot on corn, and it's not that wonderful corn that grows in ears down the block from you that tastes really good, but it's the industrial corn that has completely taken over the state of Iowa. So that is coming up, okay, at 9 a.m., I have the note here, 9 a.m. on Friday, this Friday. And I attended that lecture, actually recorded that lecture, and I highly recommend listening to it because it was a really inspiring way to go. And which, again, I'm talking right now with Eric DePlace, and if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. And actually, Eric, I wonder if we can sort of tie that in, because I don't know, are you familiar with the writings of Michael Pollan?
Someone on the line there?
Hi. So are you familiar with Michael Pollan's writings at all?
I am a little bit familiar with him, yeah.
Because he's really writing a lot about us being connected to place.
Right.
And it seems that what you're talking about at the end of the day is about us feeling a connection to place. Mm-hmm. And one way is to get out of your car. Another way is to start buying and eating locally. And I'm curious if this is something that you might be looking at more in future Cascade scorecards, is food consumption and where our food comes from and how much of the food that we eat in the Northwest is produced locally. And I know that you've done work in the past about protection or loss of farmlands
right.
in the Northwest. But it also seems that there's a whole movement now of people starting to grow food in cities again and making connections, preserving these small farms at the edge of town, but doing whatever it takes to kind of curtail the Walmartization of our communities.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if that's something that you might be thinking about for the future.
Yeah, you know, it's certainly something that might be in the hopper for our next book. I mean, it's certainly a fascinating issue that's emerging now, you know, in a really strong way. Michael Pollan has certainly done some really cool stuff on the importance of eating locally, and maybe even you know, contrasting the benefits of say buying organic as opposed to buying locally.
Right, or buying organic that's grown in Argentina as opposed to buying...
Right. Shipping strawberries up from Chile in the middle of winter may not be the best thing for the environment just because they're organic.
And not only that, they might not taste that good.
and that too. Yeah. So one thing, you know, on our blog, which is on our website, it's called The Daily Score, and it's on www.sightline.org. On that blog, we cover... some of those local and organic issues sometimes, and I think it's of interest to quite a few people. There's an interesting experiment that's been going on. We've been covering in the blog a little bit. It's a couple, I think, in British Columbia, and they started what's called a 100-mile diet, which is that for 1 year they committed to eating food that was produced within 100 miles of where they live and no further away, which if you live even in the lower mainland of British Columbia isn't a huge long distance. It's sort of an interesting experiment. It's kind of interesting to follow their adventures through doing that and kind of how they come to grips with a lifestyle, a food lifestyle that's firmly grounded in the place they live.
And you know that was actually reported in Time magazine last week?
I did not know that. That's fabulous.
Yes. I mean, well, it was very interesting. I had just gotten the copy of Mother Jones that has Michael Pollan, an excerpt from Michael Pollan's new book, Omnivore's Dilemma, on the cover, and it was a big basket of eggs from the sustainable farm, truly sustainable local farm in Virginia where Michael works for a week. But then they had a whole, so that was in Mother Jones. I thought, well, it's nice that Mother Jones is starting to really deal with food sustainability.
Right.
But then I was at the checkout stand and I saw Time magazine and it was a whole thing about food.
Wow, and that's fantastic.
And part of the food was eating local, and they had a name, a local vore is what they call it,
uh-huh.
And they had the 100-mile diet in there, and I looked at that with quite a bit of amazement, and I'm doing a show about food sustainability. A documentary is coming out at the end of next month, so I've been kind of really focusing on these issues for about the last year, but it was one thing that Mother Jones is doing, but to see it in Time magazine really heartened me, and some of the articles in Time were not all that much about the food issues that I would really like to see
sure.
championed, but the fact that they had a 100-mile diet in there was very impressive.
Yeah, I'll say. I had no idea. That is surprising. I mean, and it's great to see that kind of attention to place and that kind of attention to local diets get that kind of national play, because I think it's something that really activates people's consciousness in a big way once you start to think about it.
I mean, in here in Oregon, it's very easy to eat within 100 miles. It does mean you won't have strawberries in the winter.
Right.
But and you won't have asparagus in September. But I think that as we refine our tastes, if we get back to remembering, and for those of us who are old enough to remember when you couldn't get strawberries in the middle of the winter,
right.
and to remember what real strawberries taste like, and we are in the heart of strawberry season right now here
right.
in Oregon.
Wonderful berries.
And when you eat Oregon strawberries that are in season, you would never want to eat any other strawberry. In fact, I was in New Mexico last weekend, and they kept serving these strawberries that were from those California strawberries, and they all look exactly alike,
yeah,
every single
exactly.
one. And they're made to look very pretty. But I know from looking at them now, I know what they're going to taste like. I didn't have a single bit of fruit the whole time I was in New Mexico, because none of the fruit that was being brought into this conference was locally produced, and I could just tell it wasn't anything I wanted to eat. So you might get a little persnickety in your taste, but I think the other part of it is that as you eat healthfully, you will sacrifice in the winter. There's certain times of the year where there's really not very much good fresh produce. But if you save your, you know, you just wait for those times when things are in season, and it's a whole new experience, and you're not only living in place, but you also really start to live in time as well.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And what could be better than a fresh strawberry that's actually in season, or fresh asparagus in season?
Yeah, you know, fresh except for peaches. Cherry.
Or cherry.
Cherry season is starting now, so that's even better.
Right, right.
But somebody I was talking to in my piece was talking about how you start to look forward to things. And it really changes your life when you start to think, oh wait, peach season starting next week. I can't wait, you know, as opposed to like eating these wooden peaches all year round and
right.
not even knowing to that peach season is upon us and that you could, if you were eating, buying at a store that actually bought and sold local produce, that you'd be eating in season local peaches as opposed to buying at a store where they're getting all their produce from halfway around the world all the time anyway.
Right. And I think that sort of attention to kind of locally grown food is really commensurate with the kind of the attention to local places and cities and local neighborhoods and cities. I mean, those two, to my way of thinking, just really go hand in hand. And they're, I think, a great example of why we should pay a lot more attention to designing the place we live so that they're friendly to humans and to a lifestyle that's grounded in place.
Well, I think it's really important stuff. I'm really happy to see every year to see the scorecards come out.
Right.
So, Eric, what is up for the future? What can we expect next year from you guys?
Well, we'll be doing another version of Cascadia Scorecard. It'll be the 2007 version. We'll take another look at our seven indicators, everything from wildlife to energy consumption, population, sprawl, pollution. We'll take a look at all that stuff. We'll have a new focus next year. I'm not sure what it will be, but we'll definitely give you the heads up before it comes out.
Great. Well, I really like that this year your topic was on something. It's sort of a nice conclusion for a whole, we've been doing a whole year, basically, about sprawl and health here on this show on KBS.
Great.
So it's kind of nice to see that we're all in sync. And
yeah.
Maybe next year you'll do it on food sustainable issues.
There's a decent chance we will.
Okay, great. Well, thanks a whole lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Barbara.
And we've been talking with Eric DePlace, who is a research associate with Sightline Institute, and they've just released a pretty interesting book called Cascade Scorecard, Seven Key Trends Shaping the Northwest, Focus on Sprawl and Health. And you've been listening to what we have callers. Oh, we have some callers. Well, I'm almost out of time, but I will squeeze the callers in. So, hello, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
You mentioned not the people getting away, wanting to get away from glitz, and kind of under your on the side, you said something about shoemakers are a dying breed.
Yeah.
I noticed that it's very hard to find a shoemaker because they're really not listed in the telephone pages or they don't have web pages and things. And you mentioned you had one in Selwood. How do you find a shoemaker? I finally found one in West Lynn, but how do you find them?
Well, actually, I know the shoemakers that I've been going to for a while I've noticed them in neighborhoods. I actually moved to the neighborhood I live in for a lot of reasons, but one reason was that the best shoemaker in Portland used to be in Selwood. And I used to go there even when I lived in Northwest Portland because I had these handmade shoes and he would resole them for me. And he was a great shoemaker. He went out of business about 5 years ago and I was really sorry that he did. And there's another shoemaker in my neighborhood. He's right around the corner. I'm not quite as fond of the other guy as I was of the guy who retired. The only way I know about shoemakers is to pay attention as you're in neighborhoods and see. I mean, I think there's a shoemaker on Hawthorne. There's a couple shoemakers still downtown. They used to be a really great place, Steve's. I think they've also gone out of business. But the trouble with shoemakers is that most shoes are made to throw away. They, you know, they last 2 years and you throw them away. So the whole art of shoemaking is kind of a dying.
Right. But if you are walking and using your shoes and you love your shoes, it's a wonderful thing.
It sure is. And I would like to keep my shoes alive a lot longer than 3 years. But it's a hard
maybe
thing.
Maybe there should be some kind of a directory of services that are kind of low key like that. Because when you walk into a shoemaker's place, it feels like you're going back into the 50s.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's a project for you to try to figure out how to do, because I think there's a number of businesses like shoemakers that have kind of disappeared off the scope. Anyway, I've got to get going, so thanks
for
calling. And I'm going to try to squeeze in one last caller. So, hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air. Let's see if we've got that caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was hoping there'd be some time for discussion about the spiritual issues of what you've been talking about in terms of health in the community, in the space. I'm thinking of like the building that got put in at 34th and Hawthorne that for me has such an emotional, spiritual impact that's very scary.
Now, aren't you glad they didn't put a McDonald's in there?
Actually not. McDonald's is what it is.
Yeah.
And doesn't have that kind of intimidation.
Yeah.
And soullessness about it. It has its own thing. But for me, that's part of the weirdness. I don't know what's happening architecturally in terms of design, and I'm very concerned. I haven't seen what's going to go in at 26th and Division, but it's just very disturbing to me what's being done with high density in terms of the style of the design.
I think that's something we have talked about in the past, and we will talk about in the future, because, I mean, high density is all well and good, but, I mean, you have to have designs that people can relate to, and when they feel like these post-industrial, surrealistic science fiction buildings, I think that does destroy the neighborhood. But now I really have to get out of here.
Bye.
So thanks for calling. I think we're going to have another Whole Communities Radio Project program. Kayleen Chessie is working on a piece about our culverted streams, the 300 miles of disappearing creeks in Portland. I'm up a panel, including Mike Houck, Bob Salinger from the Audubon Society, and some people from the Johnson Creek Watershed Council. I'm not sure which one yet we'll have on. And then coming up on July 31st, I will have a program about urban farms, nature, and community gardens. So we'll keep producing in this vein. Been listening to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for joining me. Continue listening to Kibu All Day. Stay tuned for Radio Zine.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Timbuktu's World Music CD Shop, featuring sounds from around the globe, plus American roots and eclectic contemporary music. Timbuktu's, located at 4726 Southeast Hawthorne in Portland, is now open 7 days a week. More information at 503-239-0179 or on the web at timbuktu's.com.
Même autant des pics qui goudronnent des monuments et font pleurer tous les yeux des amants. On a souvent chanté des ponts à coups d'excès d'accordéon. Pour l'heure, voici que ces plomb-plomb vont louer.
Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. Today they speak with Milan Rye, who wrote the book 7-7. About the London bombings, Islam and the Iraq War. At 10 o'clock on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller continues, It's Happening Here. That's his year-long look at fascism in the United States. Joining him to discuss controlled mass media are Norman Solomon, author and syndicated media critic, and Brent Cunningham, managing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. At 10:30, Alon Robb hosts a special program on the World Cup, the tournament mesmerizing billions around the globe this month. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now! Focuses on the movement to end violence against women across the globe. The guests are playwright and activist Eve Ensler, creator of the Vagina Monologues, and prisoner rights activist Kimberly Crenshaw. All that coming up on the Radio Zine this morning. Stay tuned for Veterans Voice.
He's 5 foot 2 and he's 6 feet 4. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Laval? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more.